The next thing I know is I wake up and I just remember, like, something bad happened to me last night. Somebody hurt me.
This is Carrie Lowe's story.
Carrie did everything, quote unquote, right. She reported right away.
Her legal team says police systematically mishandled her case.
Meanwhile, her attackers remain at large.
I'm Maggie Rahr, and this is Carrie Lowe Versus. Available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Brent Bambury. This is Day 6.
Most of North America will see at least a partial solar eclipse coming up on Monday.
You are not going to want to miss this.
It gets really dark. All the animals get really quiet.
This is a gift.
But I'm sure my song will be playing all over the world.
The long shadow of a solar eclipse in astronomy, archaeology, and Bonnie Tyler. That's coming up on Day 6. Today, Israel under pressure.
Since October 7th, the government's popularity plunged.
Facing global censure and an unpopular government, Israelis still support the war. The wrong kind of clicks.
They actually court these sort of followings.
Preteens on Instagram attract predators. But some parents opt to keep posting. And subverting the puzzle.
I understood myself to be an outlier.
How women widen the frame of crossword puzzles. All today on Day 6, the Thinking Inside the Box edition.
We have been preparing for these total solar eclipse for over 3 years now.
That is Marie-Georges Bélanger, the head of customer service for Mont-Mégantic National Park in Quebec. And if you're suddenly feeling bad about not being ready for Monday's total solar eclipse, I'm right there with you. Mont-Mégantic is an astronomy hub as well as a national park, and it will be directly under the path of the eclipse.
It's something really rare, special. It's moving. For us, particularly in Mont-Mégantic, we are the capital of astronomy on the East Coast, so it's a nice place to be to feel the enthusiasm of all the people that will be here with us.
More than 2,000 people have booked a spot to witness the eclipse there, and Marie-Georges says they better dress warmly.
Since it's still winter here, we are still expecting a big snowstorm this week. There's a lot of snow still in the mountain, so we cannot bring people on the top on the road. It's not possible. So the observatory on the top will not be accessible for the public, but we will have a live stream from the top of the mountain.
Mont-Mégantic isn't the only place expecting a crowd.
Originally, I thought it'd be mostly just the local community. But then an employee here sent me a notice that went out about people taking a bus from St. John's to come here. So I think it's going to be busy.
That is Jennifer Strickland, the campus director for the Gander campus of the College of the North Atlantic. She says they've been getting a lot more calls about the events they're hosting.
You know, I think as it gets closer, I find that the energy is shifting and that more people just want to be here. And hopefully the weather cooperates just for a couple minutes, that's all, so we can see it.
Long before we could live stream the magic of an eclipse, people still found ways to record their wonder about what was happening in the sky. And that is the basis for the interdisciplinary field of archaeoastronomy. Sarah Sadovoy is an astrophysicist at Queen's University in Kingston. We asked her how records of previous solar eclipses have helped us better understand human history.
Archaeoastronomy, or astroarchaeology, I like to call it astroarchaeology, is basically using astronomical records as a way of better understanding Earth historical moments. So this could be a particular moment in a given society or a particular moment in terms of a disaster that happened or in terms of, you know, what people were doing and thinking at that time. It's a way of just better understanding our own human history through astronomical events. Where solar eclipses fit into this astroarchaeology is you need to know a particular time and place for a moment in history. And because eclipses are these momentous occasions, the sky goes dark in the middle of the day, it's hard to not take notice of this effect. So people all over the world recorded eclipses happening because The sky went dark. They didn't expect it to. And if those records happen to coincide with other events in human history, and if we can somehow date that particular eclipse, then we can identify the date of those other events that coincide around the same time as the total eclipse. One of the oldest eclipses that we've ever dated and we have a good accurate date for is from March 5th, 1222 BCE. It was a record that is, you know, etched into this clay tablet from a city called Ugarit in what is now modern day Syria. It was a city that fell to invasion. The fact that this tablet survived means that, you know, the invasion happened after this eclipse event. We have records of eclipses from thousands of years and from every corner of the globe where people will say things like the sun was extinguished, the sun was eaten. Those are our cues that there was a total solar eclipse. So there's this narrative that goes around this mythic theme that something is attacking or making a meal out of the sun. And it just was so fascinating how different cultures, you know, developed their impression of what a solar eclipse is. Different parts of the world came up with similar stories and similar perspectives, even though they were probably never talking to each other. So, for example, in some cultures, there are these giant dogs or wolves that are chasing the sun and the moon, and that's what makes lunar and solar eclipses. And that's something that has been seen in Scandinavia, you know, the Viking sky wolves, and in Korea with the fire dogs. A lot of cultures, Mesoamerica, came up with, you know, snakes and serpents, and that's something that's, you know, very similar to what's been seen in Hungary and even like Mexico. Some people, it was demons. This is something from the Cook Islands and Tahiti, as well as India. You've got a demon that is attacking and eating the sun. I love how different people had very similar reactions. On average, you're looking at about 400 years for a total solar eclipse to land over a particular patch of the Earth. Where I am in Kingston, we are in the path of totality for April 8, 2024, and we haven't had a total solar eclipse in 675 years. So not since December 10th, 1349. I am hopefully going to be standing in sunshine and then standing in the moon's shadow on the day of the eclipse. That is what I hope. I have never been in a total solar eclipse. From what I've been told by from people who have been in total eclipses, the difference between total and not total is all of the difference. I hope I'm with a group of people who are just as excited to see a total eclipse as I am. We'll experience this once-in-a-lifetime event, at least for the city of Kingston, with me.
Sarah Sadovoy is an astrophysicist at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario.
There are three types of eclipse. You've got the lunar eclipse, the solar eclipse, and then there's the total eclipse of the heart.
Yeah, that's right. Because for a lot of us, you can't talk about an eclipse without thinking of this.
Once upon a time, there was light in my life, but now there's only love in the dark. Nothing I can say, a total eclipse of the heart.
Welsh singer Bonnie Tyler released Total Eclipse of the Heart in 1983. It spent 4 weeks at the top of the Billboard charts, and 41 years later, everyone is still singing it. And thanks to some kind of celestial serendipity, the radio edit of Total Eclipse is almost the exact length of Monday's solar eclipse. Bonnie Tyler, good morning. Welcome to day six.
Good morning, you.
Oh, it's wonderful to hear your voice. Let me ask you, 4 decades ago, before you recorded Total Eclipse of the Heart, how much did you know about these celestial events called eclipses?
Obviously, a lot more after I recorded Total Eclipse of the Heart, because my phone doesn't stop. You know, my emails are coming in like fast and furious every time there's an eclipse, you know. And it's, you know, to work with Jim Steinman, was a dream come true. I always wanted to work with him. And Jim Steinman wrote iconic songs for both.
Oh, yes.
Myself, Meatloaf, Celine Dion,
yes,
Barbra Streisand, you name them, you know. I mean, but I wanted, it was my dream to work with him, and I got it.
So how did you end up meeting Jim Steinman?
Well, I had just finished my contract with RCA Records, and they wanted to re-sign me for another 5 years, which was a huge compliment. But I had my sights set on working with Jim Steinman. I had no idea if he would work with me. And my record company thought I was absolute, my new record company, I signed to Sony then, you know, which was CBS at the time. And when the head of A&R asked me who I wanted to work with, and I said, I want to work with whoever writes and produces Meatloaf stuff, you know. He said, Bonnie, it's Jim Steinman. I said, yes. So, and he said, hey, Bon, he's never going to do it. He's never going to work with you. You know, you're a country rock singer. I said, ask him. You never know. And it's my dream. You're asking me who I want to work with. And I'm telling you, I want to work with Jim Steinman. So they said, oh, don't hold your breath. So they did ask him. And he was a bit flabbergasted that Bonnie Tyler should ask him, you know, to work with her. And he only ever knew, apparently, it's a heartache.
Yeah.
And but he was intrigued by the idea. And he sent a message to say, I'd like to meet Bonnie. Could she come to New York? And we got on very well. And 3 weeks later, he actually finished writing a song he'd started writing years and years and years ago. But he finished writing it and he gave it to me. And Meatloaf was totally gutted, bless him. He said, Bonnie, that song should have been mine. I said, I got it.
I saw a description that Jim Steinman was asked about you, and this is how he described you: a Welsh dairymaid with a lusty body.
I don't know about that, but I'm far from a dairymaid. But but he did say he knew I had a powerful voice and he could work with me. Yeah.
But this is a long song. This is a dark, long song. It's
yes,
a journey.
It
you
broke
know?
Jim's heart to have to edit it from nearly 8 minutes to 4 minutes 50 for the radios to play it. But they loved the record so much in the end, they were playing the full version, you know. It went to number one in America, I think, for yes. 4 weeks.
Yes.
In the top 10 all over the world, you know. It's a mega, mega hit. And I never, ever get tired of singing it. And I'm still touring. I'm 72 now. I'm 73 in June. I'm still touring like hell. Yeah, but and I've got a live album coming out, so you can hear Total Eclipse of the Heart live. It's coming out on the 19th of April, live in Berlin.
Okay.
With my extraordinary, wonderful band, who have been with me for over 30-odd years. And I've been very, very lucky, you know.
You said that Jim Steinman's heart broke when he had to edit the song down. But what does it do to your heart when you start to sing it? Because you know you've got some pretty big notes you have to hit in that long journey.
Well, I have to be honest with you. I have taken it down one tone since
okay.
I recorded it. You know, I travel so much. I tour so much, I mean, that it makes it slightly easier. And I love singing it, you know. And, of course, the audience go mad. They all love it. And he wrote so many incredible, iconic songs, you know. I mean, how many times have you heard Holding Out for a Hero, Total Eclipse of the Heart, on the radio or on these talent shows that people go on, and adverts? My God, I've lost count of how many adverts use them on the British television, you know.
What can you tell me about making the video for Total Eclipse of the Heart? Because that is such a bonkers, memorable video. And you do a lot of running in that.
Yeah. It was freezing cold and I had to run barefoot through the snow. It was a very hard one to do, but it was incredible. I had total faith in Jim Steinman's storyboard, you know.
Right.
And, of course, MTV had just started to air. And
yes.
They were crying out for amazing videos. And he just, it's all down to Jim Steinman, you know.
Bonnie Tyler, do you have any advice for eclipse watchers on this side of the Atlantic?
Well, apparently you really should have special glasses, but I don't know. You better check the internet for that. But I'm sure my song will be playing all over the world somewhere.
And long afterwards as well.
And I'll be doing it on stage. Well, not on the 8th, because I'm traveling on the 8th. I'll be doing it on the 9th again, and I love it.
We're looking forward to your live album when it comes out later this month. Bonnie Tyler, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been great. Bye-bye.
Bonnie Tyler released Total Eclipse of the Heart in 1983. She's heading out on tour across Europe on Tuesday.
Only love in the dark. Nothing I can say. A total eclipse of the heart.
Still to come on day 6, how Beyoncé's version of a Paul McCartney classic reanimates the song's civil rights roots.
The economy is wrecked. Gaza is wrecked. Our situation is wrecked. Our diplomacy is wrecked. Everything is broken. We need the new government to bring back Israel to what it can be.
Protests against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reached a new level of intensity this week. Tens of thousands of people rallied around the country for 4 days straight. Some want the government to do more to get the remaining hostages back. Others want a ceasefire. Many want Netanyahu to step down. Tomorrow marks 6 months since the Hamas attacks of October 7th, and to take stock of where Israel is in this moment, I'm joined by Dalia Shindlin. She's an Israeli political analyst, pollster, and writer. Her new book is The Crooked Timber of Democracy in Israel, Promise Unfulfilled. Dalia, good morning. Welcome back to Day 6.
Thank you for having me again.
The protests in Israel against Netanyahu and the Netanyahu government seem to be intensifying. How significant do you think they are?
I think they are significant for reviving some of the energy that we saw during the protests of 2023, which were heady. They were unprecedented, and there was a strong sense that of people power at that time. Mm-hmm. Despite the very difficult mission of 2023, which was to try to stop the government's plans to undermine the independence of the Israeli judiciary, there was some success. That program was rolled back and slowed down, and the protesters felt like the enormous effort was paying off, you know, with cautious optimism. And I think that what they're trying to do now is bring back that same show of people power. You know, it's an old slogan, but it really you really saw it materialize in front of your eyes in 2023. And I think that they're trying to recreate that feeling of an extraordinary moment to show that presence to the elected officials and say, you know, we have lost confidence in you. You have failed. You have breached the contract between citizens and the leadership and the state. And you need to, go home. You need to call new elections and face the public and the public's new choice.
And but you are a pollster. What do you see about the popularity or the unpopularity of Benjamin Netanyahu and his government right now? What do the numbers say?
The numbers are very clear. Since October 7th, the government's popularity plunged. The government was already losing popularity and, you know, had lost significant popularity in 2023. And I keep going back to 2023 because it really set the stage for what we're seeing now in terms of the public loss of confidence in the government. Already in all surveys in 2023, because of the government's very extremist plans and its attempt to undermine the constitutional order in Israel, the government had lost its majority in surveys. So from 64 seats, a majority had gone down to about 52 or 54 seats in most surveys before October 7th. Mm-hmm. After October 7th, the government then plunged further and is now getting in almost all surveys between 44 and 46 or maximum 48 seats or as low as 42 seats out of 120, which means the government barely holds over a third of all legislative seats and it has lost about one third of its support. That's a serious hit, and those surveys have been remarkably stable since October 7th. We've had over 40 surveys now published in Israel, I would say. And we're seeing, you know, very stable patterns. Also, the Likud party, the ruling party, has lost over 40% up to 50% of its votes in some surveys. That's Mr. Netanyahu's party. So really, they've lost almost half their support. Netanyahu himself has taken a deep dive in his own personal ratings. Only about 28% of Israelis trust him right now. And this is a new development. This is a prime minister who, for years of being a very long-term incumbent, he's the longest-serving Israeli prime minister, and yet, he still enjoyed, I would say, enviable levels of support, which means between 40 and 45% for an incumbent of that length. That's a pretty robust level of support in Israeli society, and that has dropped, and it has not recovered since October 7th.
The numbers are bad then for Netanyahu and his government and for Likud, but what did the poll say about how Israelis feel about the war in Gaza?
So Israeli Jews, by an overwhelming majority, believe that Israel is using the right amount of force or that it should be using more force. At least that's the data that we have back from January. Mm-hmm. We also know that a majority of Israelis, depending on the survey, can range between 55 and 65% of Israeli Jews oppose humanitarian aid or don't think that Israel should take into account humanitarian needs when defining its war aims. Mm-hmm. Or a strong majority, over 80% of Israeli Jews, again, back in January, thought that the number of casualties was justified. There's no way to kind of pretty up that data. It's a very serious finding. Israelis are definitely prioritizing the war over the suffering in Gaza, that is, the Jewish Israelis. Of course, Palestinian citizens of Israel take precisely the opposite approach.
Right.
So that's, you know, deep divide within Israeli society, but Israeli Jews are, of course, the majority. They're about 75%, and they show overwhelming support for these different aspects of the war. And when you ask the question, it's specifically phrased as the prime minister talks about it, which is complete victory, only 39% of Israelis say they believe that that can happen. Mm. And that's largely because they distrust the prime minister, and it's his language, and because he has refused to define exactly what complete victory means. And so I think that, you know, that is expressing itself sort of at the margins of those big majorities that still support the war because they see it as a war of survival, an existential need given what happened on October 7th. They view Hamas as an ongoing threat. Remember, rocket fire has never stopped. So if any Israelis thought they could go back to normal, the sense that Hamas still threatens Israel physically has not gone away because their activities have not gone away. I don't want to make this just a matter of psychological perceptions.
Right.
It would be a mistake to confuse the strong support for the war, which Israelis believe was foisted upon them. Okay, the way Israeli Jews look at this, Hamas began the war. They are certainly prone to leaving aside the entire Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the 16 years of the siege of Gaza that preceded this. Mm-hmm. But in their perception, the war was started by Hamas. They didn't want this war. They support it because it's existentially, you know, a matter of their security. But I wouldn't go so far as to say that anybody's happy about it. Okay, there is a very tense environment, a very depressed environment in Israel. Sure, you can find pockets of people trying to go back to normal, maybe, you know, especially in the center of the country in Tel Aviv. But I think there is a very, very strong pall over the entire country because of the very egregious effects of the war. First of all, of course, soldiers dying and people really suffering economically because mm-hmm. they're doing so many months of reserve duty and the economic damage overall to the country, the damage to Israel's reputation. And I think, you know, that many people, even if they support the war, are concerned, you know, or uncomfortable and saddened by the tragedy in Gaza. It's hard to overstate the case, but, you know, the severe levels of destruction and starvation, ultimately, this is Israel's responsibility. It is an occupying power right now.
Well, the narrative obviously was extremely damaged this week when the World Central Kitchen charity and workers who were trying to deliver food were hit by an Israeli airstrike and killed. And there's been an outcry over that. But the same day that that happened, the U.S. approved a new arms package to Israel. How do you read the relationship between the United States and Israel after 6 months of attacks on Gaza?
We saw a number of indications. I won't go through the entire list, but I think the most prominent change was that America has begun to just barely develop some tools that go beyond rhetoric that, you know, would encourage Israel to constrain itself in certain ways, although these are very, very incremental steps that have not actually constrained Israel in any way. You know, placing sanctions on 4 settlers and 2 settlements, and then just last week abstaining from the vote in the UN Security Council that allowed the Security Council to pass a resolution for a ceasefire. Mm-hmm. These are demonstrations that America is willing to go further than simply calling on Israel or encouraging Israel or discouraging Israel for that matter. But as you rightly pointed out, what really matters is the flow of arms and aid packages with billions of dollars going to help Israel in this. So there is no real appetite within the White House for any sort of constraint on the flow of arms, even if there may be some disagreement within the government, and there's increasing calls from within the Democratic Party, as we know, to at least apply American law and ensure that American arms are not being used in ways that perpetrate violations of human rights and international law. But even that is not being implemented in a way that constrains Israel. So there is a certain inconsistency in it, or even a significant inconsistency on American policy on this.
Dahlia, I don't even think we have time to talk about what will happen after this war ends, but just very briefly, it looks like a majority of Jewish Israelis might support a reoccupation of Gaza. Do you think that's right?
There are surveys indicating that a majority of Israelis are open to it, might even support it, or think that settlements would be a good thing. They're pretty surprising. And I have to say that, you know, I've been doing survey research for so long on these issues, I was even surprised. And I think that the Israeli public at large, it's very diverse. It's hard to generalize about them. Mm-hmm. But I think they haven't really taken into account the consequences. Just as, by the way, they're not really taking into account the consequences for Israel, the negative consequences, if there's a full escalation in the northern border, which we haven't talked about with Lebanon and Hezbollah.
Right.
Which became very prominent this week. And I think that Israelis, you know, who really think that it's okay to reoccupy Gaza, whether they think that needs to be the case for security reasons or because they think that Israel should own it, annex it, and resettle it, I don't think they're taking into account that this is, you know, really a game changer in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian relationship, the geopolitics of the region. Mm-hmm. I think it would be similar to the relationship with Lebanon, you know, from the first Lebanon War for 18 years. In this situation where Israel is permanently in control of a population, you know, in a hostile relationship that drives in a permanent insurgency. Israelis used to talk about being stuck in the mud of Gaza, and they meant it in a very negative way. And I think that they're not really internalizing what it would mean immediately on the ground, let alone the geopolitical ramifications. So there are very messianic and fanatic religious, you know, members of this government or ultra-nationalists, even within Netanyahu's party, who are angling for that kind of approach. I've written about why I think it is not impossible that they will try to advance that. But I think that it will have extremely severe consequences for Israel, not to mention for the Palestinians.
Dahlia Shendlin, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me again.
Dahlia Shendlin is an Israeli political analyst, pollster, and writer. Her new book is The Crooked Timber of Democracy in Israel, Promise Unfulfilled.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly.
From Beyoncé's latest album, Cowboy Carter, that's Blackbird. Blackbird is a cover of a Beatles song which was inspired by the Little Rock Nine.
Fourth week of school at Little Rock, Arkansas. Monday brought the violence. 80 members of the Little Rock Police Force faced a mob of about 1,000 outside the Central High School.
In 1957 in Little Rock, Arkansas, 9 black students signed up to attend the all-white Central High School. It was an historic moment of desegregation. Melba Patillo Beals was one of those students.
And my dad and my mom, everybody surrounded me like, are you out of your mind? They looked at me like I was stone crazy.
When Melba and the other black students showed up at the school, the Arkansas National Guard blocked them from entering.
The first few days we went, they convened a mob. And they were violently, the majority of them were violently against our coming in. When I say violently, I mean, they hung ropes in anticipation to hang us. They had guns. Trucks would surround the place. And the President of the United States, Eisenhower, sent the 101st Airborne Division to escort us into the school. So I walked around the halls of Central High School with guards.
But it didn't end there. Throughout their time at the school, the Little Rock Nine navigated intense racial hatred and violence.
First question people say is, were you afraid? Of course I was. I did not think that other human beings treated human beings that way. That's a surprise. What do you mean you're going to choke me? What do you mean you're going to bash my head in with your baseball bat? Early on, like in late September, Dr. Martin Luther King came down and talked to us a couple of times. And first time he came, I was saying, so-and-so kicked me and blah, blah, blah. I thought he was going to say, you know, oh, poor sweet thing. I see your spirits notched. Go home, go home. No, he said, Melba, don't be selfish. You're not doing this for yourself, but for generations yet unborn. I was furious at him because I wanted to go home. I wanted to go back to my old school, back to the prom, back to where people didn't speak to me so harshly.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly.
Later on, as an adult, the song comes out, and immediately I thought, that's me. I think that's me. I didn't talk it over with anybody because I thought, you know, maybe I'm being a little, I'm presumptuous to think that Paul McCartney and John Lennon are writing about me or black people. But it would turn out later they said so. Now we know that it was about Little Rock Nine and black people, but I think anybody who's being oppressed shares the desire to heal your wings and fly. We all want to fly.
Blackbird, fly.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night is a lot of what I do. It's what I had to do. Now, when McCartney recorded it, he told me, I hear you. I see you there. I understand that you have pain in the dark of night. And coming from Beyonce,
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly.
She has healed her wings. She is fine. So for her to record that song, she's telling me, hey, I'm on top of this ladder, baby. And she's telling young little black girls, I'm at the top. You can do the same. The other thing is she gets some people to join her. And those other voices are not just any voice off the street. They're voices who were denied. But she's lifting them up.
You were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly.
The thought that, for example, the governor of Arkansas is erasing or trying to erase us from a course there. They are erasing what we took a lifetime to build. It's like this train careening backwards at a high speed. And people think that we're going to accept that. And just as Beyonce did not accept the fact that the Westerners said, you can't be on our list. Well, guess who's being played far and wide? Be daring me not to do something. We are black birds. I am trying to fly, baby. I've been trying to fly all of my life. The times that I am shut down or wounded, whining in the night, and how I've been waiting until this moment, I have been looking around me and seeing. So the words are so perfect, what they're meant to be.
You were only waiting for this moment to arrive. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to arise.
Melba Patillo Beals is part of the Little Rock Nine, nine black students who trailblazed desegregation in Arkansas in 1957. Still to come on day six, child influencers on Instagram attract predators in massive numbers, but some parents who control those accounts have decided to keep them up.
Hi, I'm Damon Fairless, host of Hunting Warhead from CBC Podcasts and the Norwegian newspaper VG. Hunting Warhead follows a global team of police and journalists as they attempt to dismantle a massive network of predators on the dark web. Winner of the grand prize for best investigative reporting at the New York festivals and recommended by The Guardian, Vulture, and The Globe and Mail, you can find Hunting Warhead on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
A wordplay game, nine letters. We're talking crossword. Wordle's only six. Anna Scheckman wrote her first crossword puzzle when she was 15. By the time she was 19, she'd been published in the New York Times crossword. Later, she worked as the assistant to the editor there. Anna quickly noticed she was one of the few women crossword constructors, and she wanted to know why. The result is her new book, The Riddles of the Sphinx, Inheriting the Feminist History of the Crossword Puzzle.
The question of what words and phrases are puzzle-worthy turns out is, maybe unsurprisingly, like a very charged question. The crossword puzzle ends up being a kind of arena in which to negotiate common knowledge and actually patrol the borders of common knowledge and what's worth knowing or assuming that people should know. It's hard to know if you should call crossword puzzles an industry or a field or an art. It's a strange artifact that has a sort of outsized cultural capital and also outsized impact on the newspaper's bottom line, but it's also just like a game. I am part of this cohort of constructors who we all got involved when we were actually teenagers in the mid-2000s. We were inspired by this documentary called Wordplay.
My name is Will Shorts. I'm the crossword editor for the New York Times.
Welcome to the 28th American Crossword Puzzle Tournament.
I basically walked away, you know, inspired to write my own puzzles. Almost to the day when I started trying to write crossword puzzles, I also stopped eating. Just the sensation of tearing words apart into strings of letters and trying to build them back up again into meaningful words. I almost felt disembodied as I was doing that. I don't know if that quite makes sense, but it was like I entered into the body of language and escaped my own. And I went to treatment, and I'm very proud to say that I'm in a very, very long-term recovery. But when I got back from treatment, I had already started publishing at that point crossword puzzles in the Times, and I started to be recognized as a crossword constructor and especially as a woman crossword constructor. And so this project that had been really sort of private and cathartic became public and actually pretty explicitly political, because I was meant to be diversifying the crossword puzzle. So I understood myself to be, you know, an outlier, one of very few women who write crossword puzzles. And yet I knew that there was all this ephemera, novelty songs, cartoons, comics, that associated the crossword puzzle with women around the time of its invention. And so I wanted to understand both my personal history and the history of the crossword puzzle. So in the 1920s, there's evidence all over the place in popular magazines that apparently Americans couldn't get enough of crossword puzzles. There were hotels who suggested that dictionaries should be placed next to Bibles on the bedside tables. There were apparently runs on encyclopedias at bookstores and huge lines outside of libraries. The list of these crazy sort of hysterical symptoms goes on and on. But for me, what I found most interesting was the anxiety that seemed to be actually really displaced from actually first wave feminism onto the crossword puzzle. There was hysteria or anxiety that it was actually breaking up the family unit. There's one song that was actually quite popular called Crossword Mama. The lyrics to that song end, "Crossword Mama, you puzzle me, but Papa's gonna figure you out."
Crossword Mama, you puzzle me.
That associates the crossword puzzle not just with any woman, but with a modern woman, a new woman, someone whose desires to date, to read, not to marry necessarily, were as inscrutable to patriarchy as this 15 by 15 grid. Not only were women associated with the crossword puzzle as hysterics, right, who couldn't stop solving crossword puzzles, they also were really active in shaping the early history of the puzzle. They were early editors and constructors at the New York World, which is where the very first crossword puzzle was. There was a woman named Margaret Petherbridge, who was later Margaret Ferrer, whose job was really to sort of tidy up this disorderly form. She ultimately ended up becoming the founder of the New York Times crossword puzzle in the early 40s. I was interested in how this labor that was coded as women's work, right, like weaving with language or producing kind of comforts for the worker in his off hours, how did it become a male-dominated field? In the 80s and 90s, computer scientists got really interested in crossword puzzles as a natural language processing problem. So, can crossword puzzles be made by computers better or faster than they can by humans? And so a bunch of different programmers started working on crossword constructing software, which is now almost all crossword constructors use. Women are kind of pushed out of the industry of crossword computing and back into the home because the computer can do their work for them. There's a button called autofill, and you've sort of trained an algorithm to populate the grid with the words that you've told it are puzzle worthy or not puzzle worthy. There's a lot of us who have been trying to open up the bounds of what is seen as puzzle worthy and actually like diversify the words that are included in a crossword puzzle. And I think we always wonder at various times, like, are we taking ourselves too seriously? Are we taking the puzzle too seriously? And then we encounter these other moments that we're confronted with the sort of obviously political nature of this project. You know, I've collected lists of words from friends. I'm like, what words were rejected for you? And not just in the Times, but you know, the LA Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal. And the list is, you know, you can see the politics of the puzzle right there in front of you. It's like matcha tea and Laverne Cox and an entire puzzle that's based around the idea of WNBA teams. It's funny that we would expect crossword puzzles to be a reflection of your worldview, but that's what words are. And so I guess I feel a little bit kind of solidarity with this strange history that actually opens up onto a much larger feminist history and labor history and history of women trying to sort of change the world by changing language.
Anna Scheckman is a writer, crossword puzzle constructor, and the author of The Riddles of the Sphinx, Inheriting the Feminist History of the Crossword Puzzle. Who is responsible for keeping children safe online? Is it up to the parents, tech companies, the government? It's a pretty urgent question these days, and if it wasn't on your mind already, wait until you hear about this recent investigation by the New York Times. Jennifer Valentino DeVries and a team of her colleagues did a deep dive into child influencer accounts on Instagram. They uncovered a disturbing ecosystem of parents posting photos of their kids and a large number of adult men, including self-identified pedophiles, who follow the accounts. Their reporting raises more questions about the weight of influencer culture on younger generations and how social media platforms often fail to protect their underage users. Jennifer Valentino DeVries, welcome to Day 6.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your article starts with Alyssa. Could you tell me about her experience running an Instagram account for her daughter?
Sure. She started running this account for her child when the girl was 11 years old, and this was during the pandemic. Her daughter was involved in dance, and of course, that was put on hiatus. And, you know, they thought this would be a fun activity, and in particular, thought that it would be a good way to get discounts on dance leotards, which can get pretty expensive.
Yes. And what happened?
Well, you know, I think the photographs they were posting, some of them were just in workout gear. A lot of them were in dresses. You know, I don't want people to think this was entirely, you know, scandalous clothing that her daughter was wearing. But eventually, you know, she started attracting a lot of male followers and creepy guys following her online.
How common is that kind of experience for these sorts of accounts on Instagram?
Sure. So we, during the course of our investigation, we found 5,000 accounts, and I think we could have found many more, but we stopped at that point. And these were accounts that had been opened by parents on Instagram, because kids under 13 cannot have their own accounts, actually. And so the parents were running them. And we spoke with dozens of parents, and it is extremely common. In most cases, you know, the parents we spoke with are spending hours every day trying to delete men. But there are a lot of parents who find that overwhelming, or they actually say they want their child to increase their following. And, you know, there are a few parents who, in fact, find that they can make money by selling additional photos to men. And so they actually court these sort of followings. There's a wide range of experiences we found.
So you are in touch with Instagram's parent company, Meta, mm-hmm. which also owns Facebook. In the course of your investigation, what did they tell you about their burden of regulation when it comes to these child influencer accounts?
Well, I think they really tried to put a lot of the blame on the parents, you know, and said that parents could delete the accounts. And, you know, I think that some of the parents we spoke with put a lot of the blame back on Meta, saying that Meta's algorithms were driving these men to these accounts after finding that, you know, they had an interest in children in these sort of outfits. Mm. From their perspective, this was something that they felt that they should be able to do, and that Meta should be able to protect the people on its platform.
Meta allows the child influencer accounts to offer paid subscriptions. How and why are parents using that function? Should that function be made available on these accounts?
Yeah, you know, I think that that is a big question. And Meta, when we spoke with them, they said that their protection is requiring parents to be the ones running these accounts, and that parents should be making the best decisions for their kids. The subscription feature, you know, we found that these parent-run accounts, you know, can charge anywhere from 99 cents a month up to, you know, like $20 a month for additional photos, for the ability to interact with the child on live streams, and, you know, have a lot more access to these kids. And some of them are just behind-the-scenes photos and not anything particularly remarkable, but it was pretty surprising to me that this was going on, because a lot of the subscribers who are willing to pay this amount of money are, in fact, adult men.
And you spoke with parents who are running these accounts for their children. Some of them found, when they were confronted with this barrage of suggestive or creepy commentary from adult men who are subscribing or otherwise commenting on these accounts, they decided they didn't want their child's images up there anymore, and they shut down their accounts.
Right.
But what about the ones who decided to keep them going? What did they tell you about that decision?
Yeah, so I think some of the parents, you know, they have kids who are involved in dance or acting, and they see this as part of their online resume. I think this speaks to how important this influencer industry has become among the younger generation. Most families are not making a lot of money from this. They're getting like things like discounts on clothing or free products, and they see it kind of as a hobby almost. There are some parents who are making thousands of dollars here by selling VIP photo sets of their, it's almost always daughters, in very skimpy clothing, often bikinis or leotards, to subscribers. Those are often off the Meta platform. There are additional smaller platforms, but that was a pretty small number of families.
Well, those seem to call into question Meta's contention that it's the parents' responsibility here. Do you think it's enough to count on the parents to act in the best interest of their child?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are a couple of issues at play here. So one, there are plenty of questions to be raised about Meta's algorithms and how it is serving up children to a male audience. And I also think that a lot of parents expressed to us that they were not able to block as many men as they needed to, that Instagram would slow down their ability to block people after they blocked, you know, 60 or so accounts in a day. And so I do think that there is more that Meta could be doing here. But then, you know, on the other hand, I mean, I'm coming from the United States, you know, we at least give parents a lot of leeway in terms of decisions that they can make about their kids. Yes. And, you know, this is something that there's not really illegality here, unless you get, you know, there are a very small number of cases where parents had, in fact, been arrested or convicted for, you know, producing nude imagery or extremely sexual imagery involving their children. And, you know, unless it gets to that point, there aren't laws that are going to really be coming into play here.
Jennifer, in Canada, our government recently tabled the Online Harms Act, which is aimed at protecting children online. But it's a controversial piece of legislation that might not pass. But can legislation be the answer in some of these cases? Could it deal with some of the kinds of problems that you described today?
It can help, I think. You know, I'm not in a position to say whether something can work when it hasn't been right. necessarily written or voted on yet. But I think there are some promising signs here in the States. There are a couple of efforts to create laws that are based on the kinds of regulations that we have seen in Hollywood, in which child actors are guaranteed to have a certain percentage of their income. And I think that looking to models like that could be helpful in some of these instances, but it's really a complicated legal area.
Jennifer Valentino DeVries, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Valentino DeVries is a journalist with the New York Times.
Time, weather, and
rift from the headlines.
And here we go. It's Riff from the Headlines, our weekly quiz. Three riffs linked by one story in the news. If you guess the story that links the riffs, you could win a Day 6 tote bag. First, here's a recap. This is last week's clue.
And it's nothing like I've ever known before. Love is an open door. Love is an open door. When you're barely holding on, I'll be anything you want. Open up my heart for you. Baby, I got room for two.
Celine Dion with My Heart Will Go On. Benson Boone and Room for Two. And Love is an Open Door from the soundtrack to Frozen. And Charity Mwebazi of Toronto correctly guessed the headline we're looking for. Titanic door prop that kept Rose alive while dooming Jack. Sells for more than $700,000. Congratulations, Charity. A Day 6 tote bag will be on its way to you soon. Now, here's this week's clue.
Take me to North Carolina, where my baby lives.
Men and women,
folk, folk, we the final folk, folk, we the final folk, folk, we the final folk.
And we're looking for the story that connects those riffs. Email us your answer, put Riff from the Headlines in the subject, and send it to day6@cbc.ca. Please include your mailing address. One right answer will be picked at random. The prize is a Day 6 tote bag. You can always hear the clues again anytime at cbc.ca/day6.
Time, weather, and
Riff from the Headlines.
Ah, yeah!
And that's our show for this week. Day 6 was produced by Lori Allen, McKenna Hadley Burke, Sarah Melton, and Pedro Sanchez. Our senior producer is Gord Westmacott, and I'm Brent Bambury. It's 3 days to Vimy Ridge Day, 2 days to the solar eclipse, and 7 days till we meet again on day 6.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.